Philip Dre is a noted civil rights historian. One of his books is called At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. Dre told Ann Strangchamps about some lynchings during the 1890s.
Lynchings were huge public spectacles, huge events, often involving as many as 10,000 people. Photographs were taken of them, souvenirs were taken, they were much talked about. This was a way of not only reaffirming the strength of the white community, but also completely terrorizing the black community. Blacks who were hundreds of miles away from lynchings nonetheless knew about them and were terrified by them, and of course it was very intimidating.
One of the many lynching incidents you write about happened in April 1899 in Palmetto, Georgia. The victim was a 21-year-old black farm worker named Sam Hose. Would you tell us what happened?
Well, the Sam Hose case was interesting in that it was a case that no one really ever knew for certain what had happened. He was accused, though, of murdering his white boss and also raping the boss's wife. And it turned into a sort of an archetypal lynching in that he then disappeared for about 12 days, creating the need for this statewide manhunt that was just, you know, sort of rabid, really, and all the newspapers joined in. You know, that was a very important part of it, is the newspapers in those days really sort of were part of the lynch mob. They called it folk pornography. But the Atlanta Constitution and other papers kind of joined in to sort of find this man, Sam Hose. And his lynching was very, very graphic. It went on for an entire day. Excursion trains brought different, you know, new spectators from Atlanta to participate in it.
They had special trains?
Yes, exactly. That was very common, actually, because a lot of lynchings took place in small towns. It was very common for trains to come from the larger cities carrying hundreds of spectators to sort of join in.
So there's a kind of carnival or festival-like atmosphere to these things?
Very much so, and often kind of picnic-like, really.
So what happened to Sam Hose?
Well, the Sam Hose case was kind of important just in that it was one of the first cases to really galvanize opposition to lynching among people in the North. For instance, Ida B. Wells got involved. Lynchings of that era, these were called spectacle lynchings because they involved such a large audience. You know, a lot of people think lynchings mean hangings, but actually they often meant immolations. Lynchings were very ritualized. They often were protracted over several hours. The family of the victim was often given priority to sort of exact its revenge. If the victim was killed too quickly, it was considered a bad example of what they called lynchcraft, which was sort of this ritualized approach to execution.
I think the thing I find so just horrific about it is the violence is appalling and really hard to hear about. The dehumanization of the victim is just really hard to understand at all. I mean, you tell a story about the aftermath of the Sam Hose case. I mean, this is the case that really galvanized W.E.B. Du Bois into a very public stance against lynching. And you should tell the story about what happened.
Well, that's an interesting story. W.E.B. Du Bois was a professor at Atlanta University at the time, and he had heard about the Sam Hose case. This manhunt was going on, and, you know, gallant men were looking in the swamps, and the press was playing it up. And he thought he would write a letter to the Atlanta Constitution sort of explaining that, well, you know, these things are not always what they seem in these cases. You know, passions get sort of inflamed and et cetera. And he was on his way walking down to the Atlanta Constitution office one day when someone informed him that Sam Hose had already been lynched. And not only that, but that his knuckles were on sale in a grocery store a few blocks ahead on the same street that Du Bois was walking on. And Du Bois immediately kind of just like stopped in his tracks and said, oh my God, and never delivered the letter, basically just turned around, walked back to Atlanta University. And he always referred to that later as kind of this moment that just galvanized him, changed his thinking, in that he previously had thought that these type of problems could be, you know, reasonable people, both white and black, could come together. There could be discussion. These things could be alleviated in some way or addressed. But that this incident, the barbarity of it, had shown him that, no, something more strong was needed, that you could not really sit down and have a discussion about something like this and reason it out when this level of, you know, animal behavior was taking place.
If there is anything remotely uplifting about the history of lynching in America, it has to be the story of the people who tried to put an end to lynching. Du Bois was one of them. You also write about Ida B. Wells. And will you tell me about how she began or contributed to the anti-lynching movement?
Sure. Ida B. Wells was a journalist in Memphis in the early 1890s and had already kind of made a name for herself in a suit against a railroad that had evicted her from her seat on a train. So she was very much a rebel. What got her into the anti-lynching cause was that some friends of hers in Memphis, three black men, owned a grocery store. And she knew them to be completely reputable, upstanding, young, you know, businessmen. They wanted to make a life for themselves. The grocery store did too well, and whites conspired to target it for harassment. There was some exchange of gunfire between people in the store, and these three men who Ida knew were all arrested and lynched, taken from jail and lynched in downtown Memphis. Prior to that, lynchings had often been talked about as necessary to sort of safeguard white women from black rapists. This was a common cause of lynchings that was being cited really until the middle of the 20th century. But what she perceived was that, well, no, it was not that at all. These men were killed because they were too successful. They were playing by the rules. They had a successful business, and yet they were lynched. And so this really kind of got her upset about it, and she began doing a lot of her own research into lynchings in the South and found that, indeed, in many, many cases, lynchings were taking place for just this reason, often with the kind of cover of a sexual assault, but that essentially blacks were being targeted for who they were. Maybe they were, you know, being a little too successful, too assertive. They owned something that whites wanted, what have you.
But in other words, this wasn't remotely about protecting the community from crime. This was about keeping blacks down.
Yes, right. She made that very important distinction that this was about a kind of collective repression in a way, and she began to editorialize about it.
As the 1890s wore on and in the early part of the 1900s, thanks in part to work by people like Ida B. Wells, the big spectacle lynchings became unacceptable. Lynching really became a kind of underground secret thing, which continued on up into the mid part of the century. There's one really notorious case, 1955, the case of Emmett Till. Will you tell something about that? Because that's a big piece of the more recent history of lynching.
The Emmett Till case was one of the first cases that really kind of, it was sort of attracted a lot of attention, partly because it seemed like something that was sort of a throwback. It happened in 1955. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black teenager from Chicago who was visiting relatives in a small town in Mississippi. He encountered a white woman who worked in a grocery store. They call it the wolf whistle lynching because they say that he wolf whistled at this white woman or he said something kind of sassy. Nobody really knows. But a few nights later, her husband and brother-in-law came to the place where he was staying and took him away. And, of course, he was never seen alive again. His body was found in the river a few days later. This case became kind of a worldwide cause, really, because he was so young, for one thing. The cause of the lynching, the wolf whistle, was considered sort of frivolous, really. And also another reason was because for the first time you had television coverage. This case was one that really kind of resonated. And, you know, when the civil rights movement sort of took off later that year and in the late 1950s, a lot of black leaders kind of always mentioned the Emmett Till case as one that had been sort of galvanizing or wake-up call for a lot of black Southerners.
Well, and Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till Bradley, became a pretty well-known anti-lynching activist, and she very wisely used the cameras and photographs to help make her case and help take her son's case to a wider audience. I mean, partly, she left his casket open.
Yes, that's right. That was a very important detail, was that she was very courageous, really. Not only did she go to the trial, but before that, when Emmett's body was shipped back to Chicago, you know, he had been hideously mutilated before he was killed. And, you know, the undertaker immediately said, well, we're going to close this coffin. And, you know, she said, no, I want it to be open. And, you know, he said, please, you can't do that. That's ridiculous. But she insisted. She said, I want the whole world to see what Mississippi did to my son. And, of course, that became this very well-known. The photograph, anyone who has seen it knows it's this really horrifying image. And it sort of went around the world, and that also then helped to kind of stir a lot of interest and concern about this case.
Philip Dre is the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps.